So, how is the polar vortex treating you? And how are you treating it? Are you using it to wake up? Spiritual warriors of the tundra. Every one of you. So I'm sitting today underneath a photo of my first teacher, Betty Nelson Diosho. And she is soon to go and be with the other ancestors. Not the Buddha ancestors, although maybe the Buddha ancestors, but my tribal family ancestors. And this week I stumbled upon an interview with an African shaman named Maladoma Somme, who talked about their views on ancestors and their practices for escorting someone, even someone who maybe wasn't all that stellar in their life, into a place of learning, a place of being honored, and becoming a being that can help and guide the beings that are still here. So that's their belief, and I kind of like it. And I think on February 1st we'll do the 49-day ceremony for my mother. And we'll do a special echo chant in the morning. And then we'll, hopefully Tim will stand up there and do his thing he does, where he invites them to leave, to go. And then we take the image out in the backyard and we burn it. That's the 49-day ceremony. So, that's that. That's my mom. So I've been thinking about that, and also thinking about Martin Luther King and Katagiri Roshi. So I told Ted, we might title this Random Thoughts that are all over the place. But hopefully there'll be some things that'll inspire you like they did me. So I was thinking about, with the title of the talk, What's Love Got to Do with It? You know, that's the title of a Tina Turner song. And and it's, I like that tune, but it's not what I was thinking of. What she was singing about, I was thinking about when I went to Katagiri Roshi when I was in my 20s, probably 35 years ago, and I said, what's the role of love in Zen, you know, in Buddhism? And he said, well, first he kind of got real straight and looked a little bit stern, but I think that was really just his way of concentrating. And then he said, well, not love, really, you know. Not love, really. More like compassion for all beings. That's what he said. Compassion for all beings. I think that he could see that we, young Zen students in the West, maybe had some particular ideas about what love was, and he wanted me to be clear that in Buddhism it's about compassion, and he didn't use loving kindness. We talk about that now. So I've been inspired this week by Martin Luther King's teachings on love, which I think are uncannily close to the Buddhist teachings on love. Martin Luther King urged people to practice nonviolence based on a love that could transform enemies into friends. And he brought love to bear on the most tragic and difficult events of his time. Dr. King said, "The ultimate end of nonviolence is reconciliation. The end is redemption. The end is the creation of the beloved community. It is this type of spirit and this type of love that can transform enemies into friends. It is not Eros, a sort of aesthetic or romantic love, Valentine's Day, anyone? Or philia, a sort of reciprocal love between personal friends. But it is agape, which is understanding goodwill for all men. It is overflowing love which seeks nothing in return." So that sounds like the Buddhist ideal of loving kindness and compassion, doesn't it? Where we start with ourselves when we do loving kindness practice and extend it to ourselves, and then next to someone close to us, then a neutral person, then an enemy, which is the really hard part. You never start there. And then out to the entire universe. Sounds very similar, doesn't it? So his dream of beloved community is akin to the value that we place in Buddhism on Sangha. And Thich Nhat Hanh called Sangha the new Buddha. You know, in the old Buddhist hierarchy, Buddha's at the top, then Dharma, then Sangha. But I don't know if we see it so much that way anymore. But Thich Nhat Hanh feels that the Buddha of our modern time is Sangha, is community. And central to Martin Luther King's vision is that love is an organizing principle, an ethos to live by. Behind and surrounding all action of nonviolent protest, his sermons and his speeches were full of references to the power of love to conquer hatred. Here's a quote. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that." Sounds like the Buddha from the Dhammapada. Hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone is healed. This is an ancient and eternal law. Jack Kornfield, he has a lot of good stories. He's told this story that I'm going to read to you of one of his teachers named Maha Gosananda, who's a Cambodian monk who'd lost his family and survived the destruction in Cambodia at the time of Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge. This is what he says. "Maha Gosananda got permission from the UNHCR to open this little Buddhist temple in the center of the refugee camp in Thailand, which was 50,000 people in these little huts without much water or shade. And when the Khmer Rouge found out that the temple was being opened, they let it be known that anyone who went to the opening would be killed when they returned to Cambodia. So it wasn't clear whether people would come at all, but he was this incredibly good-hearted and loving monk. He was spared being killed. Most of his family and monastery were killed because he was in Thailand for the worst of it. So we went around ringing this bell once the bamboo temple was made, and in the central square, 25,000 people came. Half the camp showed up. And as he sat there in this dusty camp, looking out over the faces of these people, the faces of people in trauma who lost family members. And this is Jack speaking. And I thought, what is he going to say to these people who've lost so much? And he put his hands together, just began to chant sounds in Cambodian and Sanskrit that they hadn't heard for 8 years. In a beautiful tone, he began to chant one verse from the Dhammapada, which says, "Hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone is healed. This is the ancient and eternal law." And after a while, 25,000 people were singing, "Hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone is healed. This is the ancient and eternal law." It was as if he was speaking a truth that was bigger than their sorrows. Like, yes, there's destruction, yes, there's killing, and still there's no end to all of it without love. I'll tell you another, we'll read you another little excerpt. I've been looking, reading essays from this book this week as well, by Malcolm Gladwell. You've heard of him, The Tipping Point. This one's called David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. And there's a little story about Dr. King in Birmingham. Once in Birmingham, when Dr. King was giving a speech, a 200-pound white man charged the stage and began pummeling King with his fists. As King's aides rushed to defend him, McWhorter writes, "They were astounded to watch King become his assailant's protector. He held him solicitously and, as the audience began singing movement songs, told him that their cause was just, that violence was self-demeaning, that we're going to win. Then King introduced him to the crowd as though he were a surprise guest. Roy James, a 24-year-old native New Yorker who lived in an American Nazi Party dormitory in Arlington, Virginia, began to weep in King's embrace. So those are dramatic stories, right? Really beautiful, dramatic stories. And certainly we're not Martin Luther King or Gandhi or Nelson Mandela or Thich Nhat Hanh. But I think we can draw on them, I do, for inspiration to live a life that's based on this love as an organizing principle. And so, love is patient, right? Love is kind. Love is more an activity, a muscle that we build. Then it is a feeling. And sitting, doing meditation, doing healing practices, practicing loving kindness are all ways to strengthen that muscle so that we can use it when we need it. It requires moral courage and also insight into emptiness of self and other. So that's all it takes, right? Just insight into emptiness. Now we need to understand that we are basically truly empty, and so is the other person. If we can realize that through sitting, then when conflict comes up and things get tense, it's a little bit easier to step back, a little bit easier to take a breath and to let go of thoughts of judgment and criticism and all the things that come up. So one of the things that sometimes happens to people is that they experience despair. They experience despair at the state of the world, the state of the economy, the state of relationships between warring countries. And for me especially, sometimes I feel very worried, if not despairing, about the earth, about what's happening to it, about the future of it, the planet. The Buddhist elder Joanna Macy says that the numbing and denial of despair in our culture is dangerous to us because it makes it hard for us to respond in a way that helps us to feel like we have some agency and that we're doing something, right? So, I don't know about you, but sometimes I get lots of messages in my inbox of my email from different groups that are doing wonderful work, and they want me to sign a petition or make a donation, and I get lots of them every day. Do you get lots of them? Yeah. And sometimes I just delete them all. When I'm really busy and I've got a lot on my plate, I just go through and delete them all. But if I do that more than 3 days in a row, I start to feel really guilty. I start to feel really badly because I do care. I do care. I do care about the planet. I'm glad there are bodhisattvas working out there to help the situation, both politically and in other ways. And sometimes I do sign all petitions, and sometimes I do make a little donation. But I think that doing things like recycling and eating lower on the food chain and driving cars less and riding buses more are all really wonderful things. But I don't think they're going to make a big impact on what's happening, climate change, and with our planet. And I find that distressing. So I think despair, I want to make a distinction between that and clinical depression. I'm not talking about that. I think that despair is something that we can share. As Mary Oliver says, tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. That little excerpt from Wild Geese is like our Zen practice. It's our way. Now, Katagiri Roshi used to say, sitting every day, we begin life anew, day by day. Completely new, completely new. Just sitting down, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, half an hour, 40 minutes, so that even in despair, we can see this landscape, this blue sky, these beautiful rivers. We might feel sad that something's happening to them, but we can appreciate totally that they're there, totally be uplifted by them. So, despair is dangerous. But it's mainly dangerous because it tempts us to medicate ourselves or just simply numb ourselves out with denial. That's the more dangerous thing, I think. Dogen Zenji asked his teacher, I told you this was random thoughts. Dogen Zenji asked his teacher, what is the nature of the mind of a bodhisattva? His teacher said, soft mind. Dogen asked, what is soft mind? His teacher replied, it's the mind that doesn't hold on to itself. The mind that doesn't hold on to itself. So, there's another hint. There's another clue about how to live with the situation we're all in, that none of us are going to get out of alive, with joy, and awake, and that is to practice softening that identification with our thoughts, with just sitting meditation, or other things that you do. Lately, I've been taking a young man named Sean, who's 13, to violin lessons on Wednesdays, and he has a very exacting teacher. And I sit in on the lessons, and I see that each time he does his scales, he has to bring himself totally to each movement of the bow, each time, you know. Otherwise, he gets scolded. Because, you know, he spaces out, and then his form isn't good. And she's really, really trying to reteach him his form. So I told him, it's just like my zazen. It's just coming back each time, totally trying to be there, fresh as a flower, each time, coming back. When I wander off, I get caught up or clenched in the grips of a knot. You know, those internal formations that we have that come up. We see them when we're sitting and we apply that soft mind to them, to melt them, let them melt. So I told him about that. It was fun. Katagiri Roshi used to talk all the time about dancers and musicians, how they were totally engaged in total dynamic working, just as we are with sitting. So anything can be a mindfulness practice. So attention is love. Your attention is love. I feel the love of your attention. Thank you. You're so kind to come and listen to Random Thoughts this morning. And I appreciate it and I feel it. So anytime you bring your attention in a non-distracted way to a being, whether that being is a human being or your cat or your dog or the plants in your garden, that's love. That's love in action. It's not being spaced out, not having your mind all over the place, but just being there. That's love. It's a very practical form of loving kindness and beneficial action. Beneficial action and kind speech are two of the four bodhisattva methods of guidance that Dogen wrote about. And I wanted to bring them up because we're a sangha, right? And so we can build this beloved community together. But there's times, and there will be times, when we might come into conflict about something, you know. And when that happens, it's good to remember our vow. It's good to remember our intention, you know, to apply the teachings to this moment of conflict. You know, not to turn away, averse to it, not to lean in and get caught, but to try to just be upright in that moment of conflict. And if we're triggered, then usually when we feel like we're going to lose something really great, there's going to be some loss, we're anticipating something that we're going to lose, that can trigger trigger our formations that were formed when we were way back when we were little kids. And so sitting practice and speaking and listening practice in a community are all opportunities to practice with beneficial action, even when we're triggered. It's pretty hard, but can be done. But it is pretty hard. You probably noticed that in some of your relationships. It's usually hardest with the people that we're closest to. But it's part of the intention and the vow to live a life based on love as an organizing principle. So there's two healing practices I wanted to mention that Dharma centers are using around the country. Peacemaking, peacekeeping, healing practices around communication and speaking and listening. And one of them is called nonviolent communication, created by Marshall Rosenberg. And the kind of the key to that one is to speak about difficult things by using, by expressing one's feelings and unmet needs around that, using I statements, with the goal of staying in connection, not pushing away. So you have to have, in order to do that, you have to have a commitment to staying connected. You can't just try to practice that and then, you know, decide that, oh, I don't want to be connected to you. It doesn't work. It comes with that strong commitment. The other one is called counsel process. Ted mentioned this a couple weeks ago, and I believe we have some scheduled. We're going to put some on the schedule. We're going to offer counsel here as a practice, unlike Zazen, but like Zazen, in that it fosters awareness of self and other, and also connection to the people in the Sangha, to the people in your community. And it's a good opportunity to practice speaking and listening deeply, and speaking from the heart, with the hopes that can be carried out into the world. So there's four principles of counsel. It's a pretty simple process. It's a ceremony from the Iroquois Nation. That's where it originates from. And people sit in a circle. There's a talking piece. There's a little kind of table in the center, ceremonial table with a candle. And the talking piece is passed around from person to person. And people can speak when it comes to them, or they can pass, because one's presence is also speaking all the time. And there are four guidelines. Speak from the heart. Listen from the heart. Be lean of speech. And keeping the confidentiality of individuals in the group. So it's okay to talk about the topics that came up in the council, but not connecting them to an individual. So that's pretty simple in terms of guidelines. And it's actually a beautiful way to communicate. So we will be offering that on, I think it's, Ted helped me out, February and March?
I think March first, and April.
March and April, okay.
First Sunday of March, first Sunday in April.
Right, first Sunday in March and first Sunday in April. And that will be after the tea. That's after the Dharma talk. So I invite you to come to that and practice practice kind speech and beneficial action. And renew your intention to your vow to benefit all beings through speech, action. And sometimes non-action is beneficial action. Sometimes not doing something can be beneficial, right? Renouncing doing something, if the timing isn't right, or we're not in a calm place, you know, then it's good to take some time. So, non-doing, that's the big message of Tao Te Ching. So these are my random thoughts today about the topic of what's love got to do with it, with Zen, and the importance of kind speech and beneficial action. So I invite you, and I'll listen deeply if you care to share anything, or ask a question, have a discussion.
Yes. Speaking of listening,
yes.
I wonder if you could comment a little bit generally about the importance of listening to right speech. I'm thinking about your chaplaincy work. I wonder, is there anything that you particularly learned from that or that has impressed you through your chaplaincy work with respect to the importance of listening?
Yeah, I can respond to that, Ted. I think it's an honor to have a dedicated space to be able to do listening practice. So that work allows me a dedicated space to do that. It's harder to do on the fly with people, mm-hmm. right? But, you know, it's almost, it's like a friend of mine said recently, it can be a sacred moment. You know, in Zen we say, nothing holy, everything is sacred. And especially heart-to-heart communication can have that element of a sacred. So that's a deeply satisfying and really, I'm very honored by it. And I listen to people's stories. There's a lot of eliciting the story. Mm-hmm. And then in the story are the most important things that need to come out, need to be heard. Yeah. You're welcome. Anybody else have a comment or want to tell us about your despair over the I shouldn't joke because it's not really funny.
That sometimes kind of seem like music on the Titanic. It's like, well, we're really listening to this music, but the Titanic is heading into the iceberg. So, like, the mindfulness is sort of not mindful of the larger fact of the iceberg
and
the hole.
Right.
That's kind of a
spirit. It's a dramatic image, but it's really pretty apropos of our life and death. Right? Katagiri always says that life is an emergency case all the time because it's going to end and we don't know when. So if we can still laugh and still smile and appreciate the tundra and the ice crystals, then we're doing really, really well.
Yeah, I'd like to kind of offer up a bit of a contradiction to that.
Okay.
That I read some surprising stuff the other day about just world wars and combat deaths, and that from a kind of long perspective, that we're really zeroing in on world peace faster than ever before, and that you wouldn't think that given our, since we have, you know, basically an 80 and longer year lifespan, that for most of our, the statistic was for the vast majority of human existence up till maybe even like 200 or 100 years ago, about 15% of us would die a violent death, mm-hmm. like from accidents and mm-hmm. murder and all that. And that nowadays, given even the exploding population and the wars and genocide, that number is about 3% now. Mm-hmm. And that combat deaths in wars, civil wars, and declared and undeclared wars and all that have been plummeting since the 40s. And that since we live, you know, day to day and read about, you know, the atrocities and such, it seems like things are getting worse when in fact they're getting a lot better way faster.
Areas,
and we haven't lived through all that other stuff, so we can be excused. This isn't, like, purposeful, you know, doomsday. It's very natural.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think it's probably evolutionarily beneficial to pay attention to danger rather than go, oh, how lovely everything is. You know?
Right.
So that probably has something to do with it, too.
Uh-huh.
And also, another quick thing was that a lot of the economic problems in America are due to the fact that people in other countries are having better lives and are actually, like, you know,
getting to our standard, to
compete a little bit, and that's probably a good thing. And I try and remember that a lot of the things I have, air conditioning and internet and stuff, are luxuries for most of the world. Even people who, you know, don't live in what I would consider to be horrible conditions, people who live, you know, pretty close to my level would consider what I have luxuries. And those things are becoming more and more available, and there would be more and more innovation and technology to help. People are self-preserving, so we're helping to battle the pollution and stuff. And so on a long scale, things are getting better faster than they ever have. And so that's definitely something to pay attention to.
Yeah, I think it adds a good balance. You're right about those. I've read all that too, and I think it's a good thing to keep it all into balance. Helen.
Yes, thank you for talking about King, and he's one of my heroes. And the other day I was talking with somebody about Bobby Kennedy. But don't you think that While King can be an inspiration for us and other giants like that, that what we need to do as a community is to actually share our individual stories of good actions, of right actions, and being loving kind to other people. And I'll give you a concrete example. I stumbled on this video a couple weeks ago, a bus driver in Buffalo, New York, named Darnell Harvin. And he saved somebody from committing suicide. And you can actually go on YouTube and get his name, and you can see the video of the bus. In the bus, you see him driving a bus with high school students. And you see off to the right, as he's going down this bridge that was over an overpass, so down below was a highway, and he was on a city street. A woman up ahead, and she's on the other side of the guardrail, so there's nothing between her and falling off, jumping off the bridge. And he stops the bus in the middle of traffic, opens the doors, and say, "Ma'am, are you all right? Ma'am, are you all right?" And she didn't respond. I mean, what this man did was incredible. He got up out of the bus. And you can see it on the video. And he goes over to the woman. He says something to her. And then he grabs her around the waist. And then he gently brings her to the other side of the bridge. And he sits down with her on the curb while they wait for emergency people to come. And then the video ends with the student. He's in the front of the bus, and the students are applauding for him.
Wow.
For me, what was incredible about that video, and the reason I'm sharing that, is that if we're going to stop the Titanic, that is the type of stuff that we as a community need to both understand happens every day, and that can empower us. That can inspire us as well as much as King can. That kind of thing can inspire us because it's just humans being kind to humans, not giants,
right. Not
anybody big.
Mm-hmm.
But think of the difference it made in the life of that woman, that what Darnell did, and in the life of the students who saw him do it.
Powerful, very powerful. Thank you. That's really true. Really true. And my wish for us as a community is that we will nurture our ability to respond here, you know, that we will nurture that ability to respond to ourselves, to others, to situations, to the world, the earth, all of it, whatever part we think we can respond to, and to continue to encourage the things we're doing outside this little community, like the building houses and gathering, you know, partnering with the food shelves, which is so needed right now, and the other things that we're doing, the visiting, teaching Zazen to the youth that are incarcerated, that all those things, that we continue that by nurturing ourselves here, our loving kindness and our ability to respond. That's my hope, my wish. Yeah. Hi. Vina.
About Martin Luther King. Built his effort from bouts of depression and cheated on his wife.
Yes, I was going to mention that, but you did, so.
And, you know, put weight on and just health issues.
Oh, yeah. I think we all have feet of clay. You know, we're just we all have feet of clay, and you see that so often in the lives of some of these great men. You know, that there's a part of them that's not completely integrated. I still think that they've done an enormous amount of good, but it's important to be able to see that there's some holes in the morality there. You know, I still think that a person can do great things, even when they've shown that they have some serious problems like that. Yeah, that's what I thought when I was reading all this stuff about him. I thought, oh, then there's that part about him, you know, which is less than stellar. I don't know what to say to it, except for that, knowing about it. I'm not putting him up on a big pedestal. My mom is higher than him right now. So, just so you know, but... But I enjoyed reading his. He's such a gifted speaker. His sermons were so stirring, and you know, his. I just read through loads of quotes of his, and they're very stirring, and they're very, and they, a lot of them sound like things the Buddha said. So, you know, it's fun to do that. Tony.
Thanks to so many leaders. We all have faith, right? But it's just more exposed when people are stepping forward, or, you know.
Right. There's no place to hide.
Yeah,
you know,
and it's disappointing to all of us. Mm-hmm. But I think we want to be pure.
Pure, yes. We do. We do. Nice when they're pure. It's great, you know.
But that lack of purity should inspire us, because we're not pure. But we can do as well as Martin Luther King or Gandhi,
right, we can do
or whomever.
Yeah. We can act. We can make beneficial action even though we're not pure. So.
How come women don't have those backstories as much as they do women?
Oh, they do. Mother Teresa. Sorry, that is a very Zen-like.
Explain the concept of Christ.
We're just really mortal and prey to blundering. Like Dogen said, my life's been one continuous mistake. And we could
actually, you know, I was actually thinking about the other way around, you know, the war and compassion and forgiveness. And I don't think this is actually appropriate coming from me or inappropriate coming from me, but the guy who lit the Pearl Harbor on deck in Japanese. Anyway, you know, you watch the movie Tora Tora Tora, the guy who sent that message, Tora Tora Tora, Captain Kuchina, he became a born-again Christian, and apparently, not only he's still alive, but, you know, several years ago, he was living in California. And I was thinking what he did on that day, and actually now, you know, turn around and live in America. And when I heard that story, I thought, God, people around his neighborhood have been forgiving him and accepting him. I don't know if people walking around and throwing rocks at him. But still, I mean,
they probably don't even know who he is. You know, he's probably.
That's the part I actually felt was more incredible.
Yeah. You
know, forgiving him and accepting him. So, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, he obviously wasn't a good man on that day, but,
right.
You know, turn around and. You know,
And that was Dr. King's message, was redemption. You know, that we strive to love our enemies for ourselves, because hatred harms us the most. The fact is that love includes forgiveness always. And Martin Luther King said it's continuous forgiveness, constant forgiveness. So I guess we could apply that to him too, and to the person you're talking about. Katagiri said, I remember this really well, that everyone has a right to live in this world, including monsters, and that they have a right to compassion, even. But then he said, but we are compassion. So even the monster is compassion. There's a lot of stories in Buddhism, like the story of Milarepa and the story of Angulimala, this murderer that the Buddha reformed and ordained and took him into his order. There's a lot of those stories that. Linda, one more.
Okay. Linda. I think judging somebody because they cheat sexually, or they have abused food and they gain weight, or they, you know, I think that sometimes, I mean, if you look at King, maybe he needed the food. Maybe the food was a relief from stress. Maybe the need for physical love was the need to escape, or the addiction to escape, or a place to go. And that, I think, could be a friend of mine who's an actor always said to me, villains don't think they're bad. Villains don't think they're bad. You can't play a villain and think that you're doing bad things. Because people don't wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to be a bad person today. You know, they wake up in the morning and they say, I'm going to do what I need to do today. And I don't need to say anything.
Yeah. I think that what you're saying is probably 80% correct. Or 85, okay, but there's always an exception to that, but I agree with you mostly. Okay, I'm just looking at the time, and I think we'll finish, and I'm grateful for you all being here and for the good discussion.